right. Ms. Miller, I'm going to be certain to ask Mr. Cochran this question, but do you see any evidence of fault in this record by your client?
I do not, Your Honor. I don't believe that there is any fault indicated in the record on the part of Mr. Mundy. In fact, the trial court in its ruling specifically made the statement, any manifest injustice must derive from the relative economic circumstances of the parties. I don't believe the trial court could have more plainly stated that it based its entire opinion on that second prong.
Was that a correct? Was that a correct view of the law?
No, Your Honor. I think that Giraldi and Congdon are both quite clear that both of those elements, both of those prongs, the respective degrees of fault during the marriage and the relative economic circumstances of the parties are necessary and required elements. In fact, Giraldi, Your Honor, even sort of takes it one step further and makes the statement that the decision to invoke the manifest injustice exception must be rooted in both, emphasis in that quote, the respective degrees of fault and the relative economic circumstances factor. Giraldi also, Your Honor, takes this another step further and speaks to the fact that there is a much higher burden of proof in this analysis as well. Virginia Code 20-107.1b imposes an extraordinarily high burden on the adulterous spouse, requiring not only that he or she demonstrate manifest injustice, which is a special term of art in the law, synonymous with an obvious miscarriage of justice, but the burden is made even higher still by the requirement that the manifest injustice must be proven by clear and convincing evidence.
Well, let me interrupt you, because the trial court in this case relied on the our Calvin decision. Calvin predated Condon, and frankly, you know, I think we've made a mess of the jurisprudence here. We've got some conflicting cases out there, and this might be an opportunity to try to clean some of that up. So, in that vein, how do you suggest we, since Condon doesn't express the word real problem, how do you suggest we deal with the dichotomy there?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think that Congdon does get us at least a lot of the way there. The court in Congdon, Your Honor, in speaking about Calvin, made the statement, this is on page 265 of the Congdon opinion, that we made the observation based on the facts in the appellate record and the specific arguments presented to us on appeal in the Calvin decision. So Congdon is making a point here of sort of saying that the Calvin decision is essentially limited in scope to the facts of that case. It goes on to say, too, that in the Calvin decision, there was at least one of the parties didn't file a brief or participate in oral argument, and that Calvin did not expressly mention, much less analyze, whether Code 20107.1b requires a conjunctive or disjunctive test. So I think that Congdon goes a long way to neutralize the Calvin decision. In that regard. And clearly, Calvin does not permit a finding of manifest injustice based only on the economic circumstances. I mean, that was exactly the issue that was raised in the Congdon matter. Congdon really gives us a good roadmap, I think, in our case here. We basically have the same issue that presented itself in Congdon presented here with different underlying facts.
Well, let me interrupt again, because I think in every case, including Congdon, if I recall correctly, there was some fault on both parties. I know of no case that had been resolved by this court or by the Supreme Court where the fault was 100% on one side and zero on the other. And looking at the plain text of 20-107.1b, would you agree that the default position is that, based on the first sentence, is that no support should be awarded if it's basically a fault divorce, and then there's an exception.
Absolutely, so, Your Honor.
Now, yeah. Getting to the exception, after the words "however," the court says the exception is where there's a manifest injustice, and then goes on to suggest, and it doesn't really define manifest injustice, but it does point to what factors to be considered, and there are two of them, and it is in the conjunctive, not the disjunctive, and it's based upon respective degrees of fault and the relative economic circumstances of the parties. So if you were in our shoes and were writing an opinion Clearly, there's some issues, given the jurisprudence that we've already talked about, there's some issues how to weigh those two things. What is the sliding scale? We have both factors have to be considered. I think Calvin is probably dead wrong to the extent that it suggests you only look at economic disparity. But how do you suggest we opine that in a way that would give guidance to you and your colleagues in the bar and to the trial court judges, the circuit court judges, as to how to apply this particular manifest injustice exception?
Certainly, Your Honor. First, I think it's a bit more than both of the factors have to be considered. Giraldi and Congdon both make the point that merely considering the factors is not enough. There must be some basis in both of the factors on which the court can ultimately make its ruling. So I would say, Your Honor, what we're looking for here is that there must be evidence in favor of the adulterous spouse under each of those prongs, either when it comes to the respective degrees of fault, either that the husband was also guilty of some fault, and maybe not necessarily to the same level, but that he was guilty of a degree of fault in the breakdown of this marriage, and that the court makes that finding, or that her adultery was not the reason for the breakdown of the marriage. And I think that that's consistent with all of our case law here. In all of the case law that we do have in this, in that has come up to this point, the wife, where there has been a finding of manifest injustice, when that exception was invoked, either it was determined that the wife, her adultery did not cause the breakdown of the marriage broke down for some other reason, or that the husband was guilty of a degree of fault that contributed to the breakdown of that marriage. And it's got to be more than a criticism or a complaint. You know, people are married 10, 20, 30 years. No one is perfect the entire course of their marriage. And to say that that is sufficient would make this rule an absolute nullity. Nobody could ever meet that burden.
Do you think you could just tell a trial court as a standard just to evaluate the confluence of evidence under each factor?
I think that would be one way of getting at it, Your Honor. Yes.
And by the way, I've been married 50 years. My wife said I've been perfect ever since.
There's always one.
I think Judge McCall and I wish we could rebut that right now. We've known him a long time.
Sir, as I was saying, Your Honor, I think that Congdon really gives us the roadmap in this case. And in Congdon, the trial court was also sort of led astray by the Calvin decision. And the appellate court in Congdon said, no, you've got to consider, look at, and find evidence under both of these prongs. It is conjunctive. And the difference in Congdon is when they applied the correct analysis, there was plenty of evidence in the record to support the manifest injustice, finding. In our case, we do not have those underlying facts. It's
incumbent, unless I'm mistaken, the wife was making $10 an hour working as a clerk, and here this woman's got $1.8 million in assets.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. Congdon differs both in terms of the respective degrees of fault and financially.
In fact, the wife has more in terms of the asset takeaway than the husband.
She does. She has nearly double the assets that the husband received out
of. Now, of course, balancing that out is a huge disparity in earning potential.
No question, and we couldn't argue otherwise, but I think what's relevant in looking at that is the statute. When we have to look back to the statute, and the statute says clear and convincing evidence of a manifest injustice. It doesn't say clear and convincing evidence of an income disparity or of a financial disparity, and I think that that's what the wife would argue in this case, and what she would like you to believe is that a clear and convincing financial or clear evidence of a financial disparity, ergo equals manifest injustice.
Do you think that the trial court here, in doing the economic comparison, strayed off into sort of an equitable distribution kind of thought?
I absolutely do, Your Honor, and I think that that's borne out in some of his comments that the trial judge makes when we were in closing argument, in saying that, well, isn't manifest injustice really about a long marriage and the vicissitudes of life and kind of going through that struggle together? And that really bears on the 2107.1 support factors in determining how much support to award. Not a manifest injustice argument. And I think we also have to be mindful of the fact that this rule, this code section, It is a penalty. There are consequences to having committed adultery, which clearly happened in this case. And one of those consequences is this code section. And I think that there are some judges, particularly when they want to look at it in an equitable type of fashion, would say that this is a harsh result.
And well, whether we agree with it or not, I mean, the General Assembly has, it seems to me at least, has said in a fault divorce situation, support isn't appropriate unless the circumstances are, I guess the thinking is, even if someone's at fault in a divorce, we don't want to leave them totally destitute or totally, you know, without
right.
any means of support.
Right.
The question is, by using the language they did, I'm not sure the General Assembly really helped us figure out where that point is. Because if it is a weighing, fault on one side versus fault on the other, economics on one side versus economics on the other, and how you mesh all those together without any guidance as to how much weight to give one versus the other, I'm struggling, frankly, with coming up with something that'll be meaningful to the practitioner as well as the trial court.
I think that the question here also goes to what constitutes a manifest injustice, and can someone who has nearly $2 million fall into that intended category of a manifest injustice when the General Assembly drafted this language? And I would say that that is certainly not the case. And I see I'm into my rebuttal time. So.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Steve Cochran for Mrs. Mundy. I have my associate.
Mr. Cochran, what evidence is in the record of fault on the part of the husband?
That's just what I was going to tell you, Your Honor. And I would suggest to the court that we're going down a very steep path here when we get into this diagnosis. But if you look at the judge's decision, which is at 1075 and 1076 of the appendix, the judge says Mrs. Mundy's chief complaint about Mr. Mundy is that he did not sufficiently meet her needs for intimacy.
Sorry, could you speak up, please?
The judge says that Mrs. Mundy's chief complaint about Mr. Mundy is that he did not sufficiently meet her needs for intimacy, physical affection, and daily attention. She felt that Mr. Mundy spent much too time focused on children and work, didn't pay attention to her.
What she also said, didn't she? He works too much, but I don't want him to work so much, but I don't want my income to come down. Didn't she also say that?
She said that she asked him, and he agreed that she had asked him to work less and spend more time with her, and his answer was, maybe when the kid's education is paid for, I'll agree to that. But I call the court's attention to Judge Devine's ruling, which I would suggest is a well-considered and thorough ruling. Yes, he says that there is no significant fault on the part of the husband. That doesn't mean that there is no fault. And we cited pages 11 and 12 in our brief, the testimony that shows the fault of the husband. But I think it's clear from the judge's ruling that he didn't find, as I called him, St. Ted, facetiously, without some fault. And there was some fault. And the question I think that the court is trying to address is, I don't think the record suggests, because the court's decision is entitled to significant deference unless you find that it's totally wrong or lacking in evidence to support it. So the court has found that there has been some fault, even though the fault weighs heavily in the husband's favor. But the court has weighed that, Your Honor. You look at Congdon, and Congdon is an interesting situation.
Well, in Congdon, both the trial court and Judge Kelsey, the husband had been guilty of 20 years of vile and abusive behavior to his wife, his children, and their extended family.
That is true. He was a profane and apparently a very obnoxious man. My question is, and in Calvin, by the way, which I think the court is prepared to say we should ignore, but in Calvin, there's no evidence of any fault whatsoever on the husband's part, and support was still awarded. This court upheld the award. But the question is, as Ms. Mullett advances in her brief, do you have to meet both prongs, or is it a consideration of all the evidence as to each? And if we take that to the conclusion that I sense this court is going, do you have to meet a prong when it comes to fault or lack of fault? Is the standard?
Isn't that what the statute says, though?
Well, Congdon says, isn't it?
The statute doesn't say that you have to find no fault.
It says you weigh the relative degrees of fault.
That's correct. So, I think what Ms. Mullins is suggesting, and I think what you would have to do to reverse Judge Devine's decision, is to say the evidence, despite Judge Devine's finding of some fault, suggests that Mr. Mundy is totally innocent. And you'd have to establish a standard, Judge Humphreys, as you were inquiring about. What is the standard? If there's no fault on the part of the husband?
The standard is clear and convincing evidence.
Well, the question is, what degree of fault? The statute says weigh the degree of fault in the economic circumstances, or the law says that. So what is the degree of fault that has to be met by the party seeking to not pay support? Is that degree zero, or is it 5%? I think it's truly a slippery path.
But apparently, the record seems to reflect in the court's remarks and both its citation to Calvin was the court did not consider fault at all, only the economic disparity of the parties.
But if you look at the decision, I don't think that's the case. The judge discusses at great length the 1074, 75, and 76, the fault issues in the case. He talks about the contributions non-monetary by Mrs. Mundy. He talks about the complaints that she had. He talks about what a good father Mr. Mundy was. But the issue here is, if he has weighed the degrees of fault, which I suggest to the court his decision says he has, and if he's weighed the economic disparity, then you have to find an abuse of discretion before you can reverse that decision, or you have to establish a standard, and I don't know how you do that, as to what the degree of default has to be.
Well, how could we possibly do that in light of the statute? How could we say 40 degrees of fault?
But you can't.
You can't do that.
So it would be an exercise in futility for you to do that, Your Honor. Even your wife would agree with that.
I don't know about that.
But if in fact the judge has both said, I have weighed the degrees of fault, I have weighed the degrees of economic disparity, and if his ruling has a basis, it is not clearly wrong and totally lacking in evidence. And I submit if you look at 1074, 75, and 76, you will find in his ruling, and you will find if you look at pages 11 and 12 of our brief.
We'll give you this hypothetical. Suppose we had a factual situation where the wife had cheated on the husband three times. The husband had cheated on the wife twice. Husband makes $150,000 a year. The wife is capable of earning $80,000 a year based on her degree, her education, whatever. And the trial court considers all of that and says, I find, based on the relative degrees of fault and the economic disparity, that I'm still going to award the wife support in the amount of $20,000 a month, just picking numbers out of the air. And that came to us on appeal. Is it enough for the court just to say, okay, that's what I did, and we're now bound to affirm that because the court used the magic words, or do we do an independent analysis of, well, wait a minute now, looking at the adulterous situation, is three times, worse than twice, or do we look at a bigger picture beyond just that, as Congdon suggests, other issues in the marriage that might have been going on that might not have been necessarily grounds for divorce, but issues that would be considered to be detrimental, I guess, to a finding of someone being a great spouse versus economic disparity of a fairly minimal nature versus, the destitute spouse that's being left with virtually nothing. And the other spouse having it all. So, how do we apply?
Well, Well, I think if you have that fact situation and those income numbers as you've described them, you would have certainly a decision that was either plainly wrong or lacking evidence to support it. But you don't have that here. And if you compare this case to Congdon, as Judge Haley started to do, putting aside the fact that in Congdon there was more fault on the husband's part than we have here. In Congdon, the husband was making $250,000. As Judge Haley said, wife was making $10 an hour. In this case, you know, the husband's making $850,000. The court found that the wife was incapacitated because of debilitating migraines, and although she had the ability to work,
found she was imputed potential income to her of $30,000 to $40,000 a year.
He did that, Your Honor, but the judge said, he concluded, and it's in a couple different places in his ruling, that based upon the problems with debilitating migraines, you know, he did not believe that she could work full time. So he found that she could work part time. So she has an income of $27,500 to $33,000 a year. She's been married 25 years. We have two adult children, he makes $850,000 a year. You know, every evidence in the record
what
was.
What does the length of the time they've been married have to do with it?
Your Honor,
question of economic comparison and fault. What is it? Supposed to say they've been married 3 years. Does that make a difference?
I think it does, Your Honor. I think it does in the trial court's mind. It may not in the appellate court's mind, but
Doesn't it stray into equitable distribution, et cetera?
Well, it strays into the amount and duration of support, Your Honor. Certainly. I don't think it strays into equitable distribution. And I think on the asset side, you know, Mrs. Mundy is not impecunious. I can't with a straight face even try to make that argument. But there was a $2 million marital pie. They each got half. She happened to have worked before and during the original years of the marriage. She earned a pension at Exxon, you know, which by good fortune was worth $840,000. That was a separate asset. But she's 55 years old. Even assuming she works part-time and makes $30,000 a year, you know, she'll dissipate those assets to maintain the standard of living that these two enjoyed during their life.
What difference does it make if it's separate, hybrid, or marital property? What difference does that make in this statutory posture? Suppose she inherited $10 million.
Well,
you just say, well, forget that. That's a separate property.
You know, I think it would certainly make a difference as to the amount, Your Honor. Ms. Mullett's argument seems to be that she's a very wealthy woman. She is wealthy by most standards, but that wealth came in large part from premarital assets, Your Honor. I think the problem again, and I apologize for repeating myself. There is evidence in this record from Judge Devine's decision. There's evidence that we've cited at pages 11 and 12 of our brief that while Mr. Mundy was a very good man, he was not perfect. There were issues of fault. There were stresses in the marriage. And you're going to substitute your judgment for that of Judge Devine and say, wait a minute, he's fault-free. And you have to meet that first prong of fault in some way, shape, or fashion. I don't know how you define that. And unless you find that he was plainly wrong, or there's just no evidence to support his decision, I think his decision has to stand. If the court doesn't have any more questions, I've said more than I did.
The briefs were very well done. You cited all the cases. I couldn't find any cases beyond the briefs. The analysis was very thoughtful on both sides. So that's why I'm sitting here quiet, because you were very helpful in the briefing.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
All right.
There was no fault found on the part of the husband, and I would submit that an absence of fault, as we have here, simply does not meet the requirements of the code.
Are you suggesting that zero fault equals no support under any circumstances?
Well, in practical application, unless the wife's adultery did not cause the breakdown of the marriage. That's what the cases would bear out. That if there is zero fault on the part of the husband, that first prong is obviously not met, and thus, unless the facts of the case bear out that her adultery did not have an impact on or cause the breakdown of the marriage, then I would say that is a correct reading of the statute, Your Honor. It requires both of those components. And in practical application, there's going to be an economic disparity in every spousal support case. But the legislature has plainly stated in drafting this statute that financial considerations alone are not enough to find manifest injustice.
Well, could I ask you, are you saying that if a court found there was absolutely no fault on the part of the husband, okay, none, but husband's making $250,000 a year, and wife has no education and no income, and there's been a single act of adultery, are you saying that under those circumstances the court would be precluded from awarding some spousal support?
I think under the plain language of the statute that would be the case, unless it was shown that her adultery did not cause the breakdown of the marriage. Because then otherwise, if you take the fault component out of this statute, you basically just have a regular child or spousal support case. You have an economic disparity in every spousal support case. If you remove that required comparative degrees of fault component, this is just any other spousal support case.
But you don't need that to win. I mean, because you have assuming he has some measure of fault, it's to, a molehill to a mountain. And so then you turn to the economic circumstances. She's not destitute. She has some at least minimal earning capacity, and she has substantial assets in addition. So you don't need to go as far as you're suggesting.
I absolutely agree with that, Your Honor. We do believe that the trial court misapplied the statute and that both of those prongs are required. But I think that even under just looking at the sufficiency of the evidence, there is not clear and convincing evidence of a manifest injustice based on the totality of these circumstances in this case. This is a case where the wife accepted the husband's statement of facts set out in our brief, and the trial court's findings are not entitled to the same deference on appeal when they're uncontroverted facts, as in this case.
Right. This is not a situation where really there's a lot of controverted facts. It could have gone either way. I mean, she essentially owned up more or less to what she did. And
there aren't, Your Honor. And I think that the sufficiency, reviewing the record in this case, the sufficiency of the evidence as a matter of law does not meet the standard of clear and convincing evidence of a manifest injustice.
Right. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Not with 15 seconds.
All right. We'll come
Thank
down
you.
And greet